Great. Well, thank you all for being here. Thanks a lot to the organizers for the invitation. Sorry, it's a little bit of a scattered start. I'm actually glad there were little delays because I'm not quite sure what time zone I'm in. I'm just still waking up here and getting things set up, but I'm really glad to be there. And I'd like to tell you about Langlands duality or relative Langlands duality for periods and L functions via electric magnetic duality. So I'd like to tell you about some work I'm fairly near completing, a long project with Yannis Sakellaridis and Akshay Venkatesh. Okay, and so I'd like to try to set it up in a way that's relevant to what you all have been learning and discussing so on the last couple of weeks. But let me first give some vague kind of number theory motivation. That's not really where I come from, but I think it helps to set up the problem. So the basic question we'd like to address, a question from number theory, is what is the spectral counterpart, a spectral version of the theory of periods of automorphic forms? So let me set up the problem. So there's something very classical in the theory of modular and automorphic form called the theory of periods. And what we'd like to do is what happens to this under the Langlands correspondence, under kind of the theory of spectral decomposition given by the Langlands program. And I'd like to try to propose an answer to that inspired by S-duality. So here's kind of maybe a very vague classical setup. So we have this kind of, upper half plane with VSL2Z acting. And we have a classical holomorphic form. Phi is a holomorphic modular form on the upper half plane. So it's transforming under PSL2Z or maybe some congruent subgroup gamma. And you could ask, what can you measure for such a holomorphic modular form? What are the natural invariants? And the natural measurements are given by period intervals. So we're going to take phi and calculate some invariants by integrating it on some counters. So what are some of these periods? The most classical one maybe is the what's called the constant term or the n period. And what is the n period? It's just going to be, I'm going to take my modular form and integrate it along, I'm going to integrate it along this horizontal line. So I'll take the modular form and take its integral along this line, which if you think of in the kind of disk picture, that's integrating along some Hoare cycle around infinity. And the integral along this is the constant term in the Q expansion of the modular form. So that's a basic invariant of the modular form that tells us if it's a cusp form or not. So that's the first integral. Another integral we could do is we can integrate along the same line. We can integrate again against this horizontal line. There's something what you might call the nth psi or Whitaker period. And that's integrating along the same line against the character of the additive group. And this picks up, I have to maybe be careful about specifying the character, but if I integrate against a character, I pick up the constant term in the Q expansion. If I write my phi as a sum of a n q to the n, the constant term is just the integral against a constant, and then we take a first Fourier coefficient, that's called the Whitaker period. So these are a couple of natural measurements. Another measurement that's natural from the theory of modular forms kind of goes the other way. I'll take this phi and I'll integrate it along a vertical line. And so this will be, maybe I'll call it the T period. The T period, I'm going to integrate my form and I'm going to integrate phi of I, y, dy over y. integrated along a vertical line, or maybe I make again just like before, I can introduce a character of the group acting, the multiplicative group, and I take this which is the Millin transform of my modular form. Again, I'm thinking of it as just this vertical integral together with a parameter, which maybe I'll call a fugacity in the current context. So it's kind of a family version where I'm weighting this by a character. This gives us, in terms of the Q expansion, this gives us what's the Dirichlet series associated associated to my modular form up to some gamma function and some power of pi, which I'll ignore for now. So this gives us this Dirichlet series associated to this form. So this is another natural measurement. And again, I think of this natural measurement as being something I get by integrating my form around some natural contour. Now, under the Langlands correspondence or the Shimura-Taniyama conjecture theorem, if we know that this modular form corresponds to I assume that phi is an eigenform for some Hecke operators, and it's supposed to correspond to some two-dimensional Galois representation. So again, I'm going through this very quickly just to give a flavor. I'm sure people have heard a lot of these things more than me. So under this correspondence, these natural measurements of the modular form correspond to natural invariants on the side of the Galois representation. So for example, the constant term being non-zero corresponds to the representation being reducible. So the constant term measurement, the Whitaker, the n period, Eisenstein period, tells me about reducibility. The function A1, the first coefficient, corresponds to the constant function one of rho. So in the theory of the Langlands correspondence, we have to normalize which Hecke eigenform corresponds to a modular form, and we normalize A1 to equal one. So this is called the Whitaker normalization. So the function A1 is an interesting function. It's the constant function one. That's how we normalize the Langlands correspondence. But the most interesting one is, again, is this T period, this L function. So this, the T period, this integral of phi, I should rewrite it. So this Dirichlet series, An, and to the minus S, gives the most important invariant of the Galois representation, which is the L function of the Galois representation. And that's kind of the invariant one it's most trying to get access to in the theory of Galois representation. So this L function, I won't give a kind of very detailed description of L functions, but we should think of an L function as some kind of character or characteristic polynomial. Maybe later we'll try to talk about it more as a kind of a version of a partition function. But the idea is that this is trying to be some characteristic polynomial. Characteristic polynomial of what? Well, this Galois group has a bunch of Frobenius elements in it for each unramified prime. And we're gonna take a characteristic polynomial for them, or really an inverse characteristic polynomial. We'll take the characteristic polynomial of this Frobenius, we'll call the parameter instead of t, call it p to the minus s, just to keep track of which prime we're talking about. And then we're taking the rho Galois representation applied to this Frobenius conjugacy class at p. So this is an inverse characteristic polynomial. And that's what the L function is. It takes a lot of care to define, especially since what we're going to be most interested in, and in fact, the only thing I'm going to be trying to access in this talk is the value at, say, s equals zero. So we're trying to get a number out of these. So when I say L function, I'm usually going to mean an L value. And those values will essentially never be defined directly. And so this is going to require this theory of Euler products and analytic continuation. This require a lot of work to make sense of, but those are this number that we're trying to attach. This L value is some kind of volume attached to a Galois representation. So maybe just to give an example, if I take rho to be just the trivial representation, The L function of the trivial representation is the Riemann zeta function. And again, the aspects that we're going to be talking about today have nothing to do with location of zeros or anything. We're just going to be interested in special value, say zeta of zero. And what is zeta of zero? Zeta of zero is, if you like, the number of positive integers. So we're trying to access what is the number of positive integers as some kind of basic invariant here. And the answer is it's -1/2. And that's what this theory of analytic continuation gives us. And again, this parameter S, we're going to think of as just an auxiliary parameter. It's keeping track of some grading. It's really evaluating the constant term on some natural family of representations where we twist by some character associated to a multiplicative. So it's really something auxiliary has to do with the grading. We're really interested just in this single value. So that's kind of the picture. We have, if you like, starting from the other side, we're starting with the Galois representation, which is expressing some interesting arithmetic situation. And we're trying to extract it out of it, a single number, this most interesting kind of invariant of it. And in order to get access for this invariant, we have to do a bunch of work because that the naive direct definition as some kind of characteristic polynomial doesn't converge. And in order to do that, we need to know, we add this auxiliary parameter S, we do this analytic continuation, and we evaluate at zero. Now, how do we know that this function has an analytic continuation with good properties? How do we know that it has, for example, a functional equation, which lets us get there? And the answer is that these are all given, this is some part of this work of Hecke and many others, is that writing the L function as this Mellin transform of the modular form automatically gives you all the nice analytic properties. So if you have the L function of a Galois representation, you'd like to get access to it. If you know that you can write it as a period of a modular form, you know it's well behaved, and you get analytic continuation, functional equation, and you can define this invariant, let alone calculate, but at least you can define it. So that's one of the motivations for this theory of periods, is that maybe we're actually interested in Galois representation, we're interested in this partition function or invariant of a Galois representation, but if we can write it as a period of a modular form, get good properties of it. So that's great. And what we'd like to understand is, where did we come up with this T period? So I started with some two-dimensional Galois representation. Maybe you've internalized the Langlands program and you believe that Galois representations should have to do with modular forms, but still, how did I know that this is the right measurement to make of my modular form? Where did this, vertical axis integral come from? So we'd like some kind of science behind matching L functions to periods. How should we know when to match an L function to a period? So this is, if you'd like, the question I'd like to access. If you like, what is the kind of science behind the kind of matching of L functions and periods? Even once you have understood how to match Galois representations and automorphic forms, which invariant of an automorphic form should match with the interesting invariants you care about for a Galois representation? And that's what I mean by this kind of spectral manifestation of a period, or if you like, automorphic manifestation of an L function. We'd like to understand the duality between these two kinds of measurements. And the kind of answer I'd like to propose, this is in our joint work with Sekularides and Venkatesh, is in the spirit, I guess all of this has been very far from this topic of this workshop, but the answer is in the spirit of this workshop. And the answer is that what we'd like to do is we'd like to think about periods as being special cases of boundary conditions for the kind of 4DA model, I think Justin just introduced, for the automorphic topological field theory, let me call it A sub G, the A side of Kapustin-Witten. I'd like to think about the kind of L functions of Galois representations as being, again, a special thing I do with boundary conditions for this 4DB model and B for the dual group, and that the relation between periods and L functions should be captured by S duality. So if I want to know which measurement of an automorphic form should correspond to which measurement of an L function, I think about them in terms of boundary conditions of this field theory, and I calculate with the dual boundary conditions. So that's the kind of general setup, and that's what I'd like to try to explain for the rest of the talk. So maybe I'll catch my breath and pause for questions. Okay, that's probably too vague for a lot of questions, but please feel free to interrupt me.
Maybe it's too early to ask this question, but I mean, you'll get to it later, but what's the actual mathematical content of this statement going to look like? Like the best possible content would be something like, there's a three category of boundary conditions for the 4DB model, and this thing is an element of that three category, but you're probably not going to tell us that.
Well, you know, it depends what how strongly you take the words this thing, right? I mean, that's right. I'd like to say something like that. What I'm going to say, first of all, I guess we're writing a very long paper and most of it is conjecture. So I'm going to tell you a lot of conjectures. So that's the first thing to say. What I'd like to explain is what are periods labeled by? How am I going to think of the data that indexes a period? I'm going to think of the data that indexes an L function. I'm going to think about matching them with the data that indexes boundary conditions for these A and B theory. Just not to make it too mysterious, it's just going to be Hamiltonian actions of Langmuir's dual groups. And then I'm going to try to understand how the matching of Hamiltonian actions for dual groups has to do with the kind of invariance. Now, of course, there isn't any mathematical theory at this point where I can talk about a topological field theory and evaluate it on number fields. That's going to be kind of a fiction, but I'm going to, using this kind of dictionary between the arithmetic situation and the geometric or physical situation to understand what kind of structures I should be looking for, and then to make precise conjectures. To be honest, most of the work we actually do takes place in this kind of happy medium place, which is function field setting, but you can still use it to make conjectures in the arithmetic situation, which is to understand how to label the data of an L function and label data of a period in a way that they match. And you realize by thinking about the field theory that there's lots and lots of structures that's connecting them in various settings, kind of TFT kind of formalism. And those you can translate to a lot of them to arithmetic statements. So that's the spirit.
Great, thanks.
Sure. Okay. All right, so fix notation, fix notions. Let's talk about the Langlands program. After Kapustin and Witten, and let's just drop this kind of distinction of geometric Langlands, arithmetic Langlands. I want to kind of emphasize that there's a Langlands program. It has lots of different manifestations, but it's really a united subject that has lots of different kind of facets, but it's not really two different programs in some sense. So I won't keep saying geometric Langlands, I'll just say Langlands. But in the Kapustin-Witten setting, we have a complex reductive group, say GLNC, and we have its complex Langlands dual group. And to each of these, we attach four-dimensional topological field theories, extended field theories. And I'm going in what sense do I mean extended field theories? I'm going to, you know, so there's the physical sense that's described in the works of Kapustin-Witten. I'm going to take various mathematical parts of it that we can formalize and make sense of. I'm thinking about these as extended four-dimensional TFTs. These have not been, well, on the B side, you can define this. On the A side, this is far from fully defined as a extended 4D TFT, but I'll pretend that. And there are a lot of parts of it that we know where they should be. And I guess I think you've been discussing a lot of these structures, so I won't go into a lot of detail. And the idea in S-duality of Kapustin-Witten is that these 4D field theories are equivalent. There's an equivalence of four-dimensional topological field theories relating this kind of A model for the group G and a B model for the group G group. And just to fix notation a little more, if I have a Riemann surface, if sigma is a surface, then the A model is some version of a category of sheaves on the moduli space of holomorphic of G bundles on sigma. There's different contexts, different ways to think about it. You can think about this, what I mean by sheaves. I could think of the category of D modules on Bunjin. In Kapustin-Witten, this is more like the A brains, or sort of some version of the Fukaya category on the cotangent bundle of Bunji or the Hitchin space. So this is the kind of category that appears on the A side. On the B side, we're going to be interested in the space of local systems for the dual group on sigma. Again, the space of local systems has a couple of different versions. There's kind of a Betty manifestation and Dram manifestation, if you think about representations of pi one or flat connections. I'm not going to, those subtleties won't make much difference here. I know we're going to take the category. We'll look at quasi-coherent sheaves, except that we have to be careful because this space is singular. So we put an exclamation mark to remind us that this is a singular space and has to be treated carefully. And so that's int coherent sheaves. So it's just the kind of the careful version of quasi-coherent sheaves on singular spaces. And the geometric Langlands conjecture is an equivalence between these two that respects a lot of extra structure. Is my notation clear? This is just to relate to how people have been discussing these things. Okay, let me know if I. There's what are the key features of this correspondence? One way to think about the matching of the key features is that it matches the action of defect operators of various dimensions on the two sides. So on both sides, we're going to have defect operators or extended operators of various dimensions acting, and the conjecture is not just an equivalence of these objects, but it's compatible with all this extra structure. Most of this won't be really relevant to me, so let me just say that there's if you'd like, there's local operators, there's line operators, there's surface operators, and so if like these are operators, if you like, of codimension four, codimension three, and codimension two operators in the field theory. So what is the local operators? This is gets interpreted on the automorphic side. This is becomes the cohomology of the classifying space. On the spectral side, this gets interpreted as invariant polynomial on the coadjoint representation, maybe with some grading shift, and these two match. And this is become the theory of singular support as studied in Arrinkin Gaisgori, and the physical interpretation of this is given by Elliott and Yu. Gaisgori. So there's a matching of local operators. The main content perhaps in geometric Langlands is the matching of line operators. This is what Kapustin-Witten studied. We have this Etoft operators on the A side matching with Wilson operators on the B side, and both of these are given by representations of the dual group, roughly representation of the dual group plus local operators, so to speak. So that's the matching of Hecke operators. That's kind of the main compatibility in the Langlands correspondence. And finally, let me just mention surface operators. This was studied by Gukov and Witten. And this codimension two defect here, again, I'm thinking codimension two defect as giving a point on my surface sigma. So I can modify the theory at a point on sigma. And this corresponds to adding ramification. So the ramified versions of the Langlands correspondence. So what does adding ramification mean? It means that I match not just Bunji, but bundles with some kind of level structure. On the automorphic side, I replace Bunji with bundles with some trivialization to some order, some similar level structure. And this is supposed to match with, I take local systems and I add singularities. I allow them to have singularities at points of the surface. And there's a matching between these extra data. Okay. So this is I think this is the fastest I've ever said geometric Langlands. I'm hopeful that this all resonates with this, what you all have been studying and discussing. But please let me know if it's not clear what I'm talking about. This isn't really where I'm going, but just to fix notations. Where I'm going maybe will be clear from this hierarchy. is that in the physics, we have not just codimension 4, 3, and 2 operators, we also have codimension 1 operators. And so the richest, story in the physics, the most complicated defects, if you like, are the codimension 1 defects. And these were studied by Gallardo and Witten. And so if you like, you can think about these as, like there's two flavors, there's a boundary conditions where we have the theory just end at a wall, or you can think of an interface or domain wall where we take two different theories. Maybe I have, let's say, the A theory from group G and say A theory for some group H, and I think about an interface between them. That distinction between boundary conditions interface won't be very, you can subsume it if you assume enough duality. I could just take this picture and fold it over. I can't draw. All right, so the idea is that you can think about taking the tensor product of this theory and think of having a boundary condition for that tensor product theory, or if you like the theory for the product group. So a boundary condition for a product group, you can think of as coming from an interface from two theories. So the notion of kind of functoriality between the theories for different groups, you could think of as being subsumed in the theory of boundary conditions, given enough duality and keeping track of enough structure. So I'm gonna focus my attention on boundary conditions, but again, if in the case, a lot of these boundary conditions come for product groups, and then you can think about them as cases of functoriality or interfaces. Okay, so, and I should also mention that this was has been studied by Justin Filsang, the mathematical theory of these interfaces, and this will be very close to what we're going to be discussing. So what can we say about boundary conditions in this theory? Ben was asking, I don't know of a three category of boundary conditions. I can define this on the B side. There is a definition by Hermann Stefanich. You can make an honest definition of three category of boundary conditions. On the A side, we have no clue, I think, what the full structure of boundary conditions is, but I'm going to look at just some pieces, what these boundary conditions does when evaluated on various higher dimensional methods, not on a point. So for example, one thing that a boundary condition should give you, a boundary condition, among other things, should give rise to an object in the category attached to a surface. Either a boundary condition on either side gives an object. And again, I should apologize, I'm going to be sloppy about duality. So I'm not going to pay much attention to the difference between an object of and a functional on. So I don't know how you like to think of a state as an element or as an inner product with an element. But I think of this as giving a boundary condition among its manifestation is a particular object of this, gives a particular object of this category attached to any surface. We have one such for each surface. They have to behave in a particular way under all the other defect operators, and they should match under the S duality. We're going to try to match a boundary condition for the A theory and a boundary condition for the B theory. So in particular, that will mean a matching of objects in this category, but it's a whole lot more structure. And we'll try to tease out some of that structure. okay, let me pause again for a second. Is that setup making sense? So let me just give a couple of examples. I'm not sure if you've already been discussing these, but Gallardo and Witten studied a lot of different examples of super, again, I'm gonna be talking only in the topological theory. So I'm gonna be talking about kind of like half BPS boundary conditions in the physical theory, but I'm thinking about them as giving topological boundary conditions. And the kind of examples that are relevant come from quantizations of actions of G and G dual on hyperkähler manifolds. So So we're going to talk about hyperkähler G or G dual spaces. And so if you'd like, this is going to be roughly speaking, I'm going to take some version of the 3D A or B models and couple to this their 4D versions. So I'm going to take the kind of data that I want to define, say Rozansky-Witten theory, it will be a hyperkähler G-dual space. And if I have a hyperkähler G-dual space, a hyperkähler space with a G-dual action by isometries, I can couple it to give a boundary condition as a physical theory. I'm only going to be talking about the topological theory. So rather than hyperkähler, I'm going to only need holomorphic symplectic. So what's the kind of, let me just make this a little more explicit. Suppose M is a holomorphic symplectic variety with an Hamiltonian action of the group G. So it has a moment map to the coadjoint representation that's equivariant. And I'm also going to give myself a grading. So let's call it graded Hamiltonian G space. So I'm going to give myself an action of G and C star, G in the multiplicative group, acting by squaring on the coadjoint representation. And that's where the symplectic form has weight two. Okay, get my numbers wrong. So I rescale the symplectic form just like the rescaling on the cotangent bundle. So given such a setting, we can construct a boundary condition on, let's say, on the A side. There's an object here which is known as the Gyodo-Lagrangian, which is going to kind of be the support of an A-brain on the Hitchin space. And so let me just make that maybe something relatively concrete. Let me talk about a space I'll call Bun GM. And so this is going to be G bundles. I look at the modular space of G bundles on sigma. So sigma is implicit here, plus a one-form twisted section of the associated M bundle. So I look at a G bundle, G acts on M, so I can take the associated M bundle. I also have a C star action, so I can twist by the line bundle of one forms, and I look at the section of this associated bundle. That's my space of Bun GM. And I can forget M, but I can remember the moment map. I get a map from this to the cotangent bundle of Bun G, which is just G Higgs bundles. So G bundles plus an omega one twisted one form. And this map, or if you like its image, defines a Lagrangian in T star Bun G associated to M. So here I've used again the C star action to twist by one forms. And this defines a Lagrangian in the moduli space of Higgs bundles. and that, if you like the quantization of this Lagrangian, this underlies a brain, like a BAA brain that lives in this, it's an object of this category AG of sigma. So that there's Lagrangian, which you think of as underlying an object in the Foucault category of the Hitchin space. And that's an example of the structure I get out of a boundary condition. So I start with a holomorphic symplectic manifold with a Hamiltonian G action. I can construct out of it for every Riemann surface, I can construct a Lagrangian in the space of Higgs bundles and think of quantizing that Lagrangian. So of course, there's something to do in doing this quantization that I'm suppressing. It's really quantum data, not the classical data that I'm interested in. But that gives me a Lagrangian. It quantizes to some brain that's an object in this category. And those are the objects that I get on Riemann surface from this particular boundary condition. You could do something analogous on the B side. On the B side, I have, again, my setup is going to be the same, except now I have the dual group. And now I'm going to have a Hamiltonian action of the dual group. And it's going to have all the kind of same adjective grading. And I can make something analogous, which you might call the kind of the like spectral Gallardo Lagrangian. I don't know if this is what it's, it has a name, or this is going to be some BBB brain on the space of local systems for the dual group. And you can define it in a very similar way. You look at the space of G dual bundles. So this is G dual local systems plus, and now you have to say flat, because you're doing local system, you have a flat section of associated M, of the associated M check bundle. I'm now twisting by one forms here. So that's gonna be my space, local G check, M check. And again, the moment map defines a map to a flat section of the coadjoint representation, which ends up being a shifted version of the cotangent bundle of the space of local systems. And so again, that you define a Lagrangian, you get a Lagrangian here, you might say, wait, where did this extra cotangent bundle? I didn't want that. This is exactly the classical limit. This is something whose quantization is a coherent sheaf. Just like before, we had a D module on Bunji. Here we have a coherent sheaf on Loc. So this extra junk, if you like, that's keeping track of the singularities, keeping track of the singular support of this coherent sheaf. So the classical limit of a coherent sheaf is a Lagrangian of this shifted cotension bundle. So that's the kind of like the spectral Gallardo Lagrangian. It's again something you want to quantize and think of as coherent sheaf. And so here we get this kind of idea from Gallardo Witten that if I have a Hamiltonian action of G, I get these objects on the A side. A Hamiltonian action of G dual gives me these objects on the B side. And I might hope that under S duality, the boundary conditions given by this class matches with boundary conditions given by that class. Okay, so I might try to match this construction of coherent sheaves for certain M checks with the construction of A brains associated to certain M's. And that's going to be the kind of duality that we're discussing. Okay, so this is kind of a bastardized version of that proposal of Gallardo Witten and Hilburn New. So let me just to fix it, give a couple of examples. Maybe I won't give the most interesting example, but just this, a simple example would be the structure sheaf, the space of local systems. And so that corresponds to M check is a point. So the simplest Hamiltonian G dual space is to take a point. So if like this is gonna be a Neumann boundary condition on for the B side. And under the Langlands correspondence, the structure sheaf, or if you'd like, if you don't wanna think about this sheaf, you can think about the functor, global sections on Loc that it represents. So there's the functor of taking global sections. That's my measurement of coherent sheaves. And that matches with the natural measurement on the A side. And so there's a very cool object, which is a very cool brain on the A side, which is given the Gallardo Lagrangian in this case is the Hitchin section. This Hitchin section of the Hitchin integrable system. This is also known as the Whitaker sheaf in the geometric Langlands literature, or it's something that has to do with the principal nonpole boundary condition, nonpole BAA brain in the Gallardo Witten language. So there's a particularly interesting object here. So when we have something that's so sort of fairly boring on one side, the dual of the point is an interesting Hamiltonian action of G. It's you take the cotangent bundle of G and you do a Hamiltonian reduction by upper triangular matrices, but not at the trivial value of the moment map, but at some kind of generic value of the moment map, which I'll call psi. Okay, so this is kind of non-degenerate character of the group of upper triangular matrices. So that's an interesting Hamiltonian action of G, and that's the dual to a point. Okay. So
David?
Yes.
Can I break in with a question?
Please.
This statement, should I think of this as at all related to the observation that if I compute the Coulomb branch of pure gauge theory for G, then I get the sort of double reduction on both sides with N of this guy as the Coulomb branch?
Yeah, I mean it's a kind of a okay. I guess maybe I'm thinking about okay. Maybe you're thinking about physics.
And this is like taking Hom of these two objects with themselves or something.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about yeah. That's right. We have these two objects, and you could take its endomorphisms of this non-pole object, and that's the Biwedekind reduction or the group scheme of regular centralizers or BFM yeah. space. And then on the other side, that's kind of the self-Hom of the point boundary condition. So that's
good. Yeah, the local operators.
Yeah. So that that's right. So it's the same appearance. There's sort of only one appearance. I mean, this Hamiltonian reduction. It's all coming from the same source. And this is kind of the basic funny. It's one of the basic funny things about the Langlands correspondence is, if you like, a very boring boundary condition, the most simple measurement you can imagine on one side, with like big global sections, matches with something that, if you're not a representation theorist, maybe sounds like very baroque. Right? And that's just a feature. And it's a feature that frustrates a lot of. So this Whitaker normalization, this is kind of a normalization of the Langlands correspondence. I make in the Langlands program, I fix the correspondence. It's not totally fixed by the other kind of first principles that you might have thought of, like the action of line operators. You need to fix fix some scalars, and that's given by matching this guy with this guy. That's called the Whitaker normalization. But yeah, it's yeah, so this is just to emphasize also that this duality of Hamiltonian spaces is very non-trivial. It sort of mixes spaces in a funny way.
Thanks.
Sure. Let me just give
you. What is the scalar you fixed when you did Whitaker normalization? Is it the choice of psi or?
No, I'm fixing psi, but if you, I'm just saying, like, if you try to, what is the idea of the Langlands correspondence? You have these Hecke operators, and you want to take the eigenvalues of the Hecke operators, and you want to, to each eigenvalue, you want to attach a normalized eigenfunction, right? So roughly the eigenvalue have to do with these local systems, and you want to give a normalized eigenfunction. That's our D module or whatever, or object. But, giving eigenvalues can't possibly, even in the best possible situation, multiplicity one situation, doesn't fix the eigenfunction. It only fixes it up to a scalar, right? So, and that's exactly the same thing with modular forms. When you say I have a cusp form, I want it to correspond to a Galois representation. I want the constant term is zero. The first Fourier coefficient I normalize to be one. Uh-huh. That's what this thing corresponds to. So I fix that the global sections corresponds exactly to matching with this brain, if you like, intersecting with the Hitchin section rather than some multiple of it.
So, but what do you mean by multiple?
I mean, this I can tensor with a vector space, right? But a Chen patent vector, whatever. I can take.
Okay. I see. Yeah.
Scalar.
Yeah.
Just maybe one more example that's maybe more obvious in some sense, though I guess physically less obvious, but just at least notationally more obvious, is that the Eisenstein series. If I think about the interface between a group and its maximal torus, given by reduction to a Borel. So if you like, this comes from reduction there's this nice correspondence between a group and its torus given by upper triangular matrices, if you like, by the flag manifold. Or if you like, this is, I'm thinking about the G cross T space, which is G mod N. As an action of G on the left and action of T on the right, that's a G cross T space. Or if you like, the cotangent bundle, if I'm thinking about the Hamiltonian space. So that gives a boundary condition for the G cross T theory, or an interface between the G theory and the T theory. And this is called the Eisenstein series, or geometric Eisenstein series. This is a relation between the group. This is the natural interface of parabolic induction, or it has lots of names, between theory for G and theory for T. And Arinkin Gaitskori told us that this should just match with the most obvious thing, at least notationally, on the dual side, which is you write the same things and put checks everywhere. So in other words, this boundary condition should match with G check cross T check acting on T star of G check mod N check. So in other words, parabolic induction on the A side on the B side should match.
Basically, this is very reasonable, I think. Although I could never find a clean enough formulation, but the intuition should be that I take my n equal 4 square meters theory and I move to the to this non-trivial vacuum where the gauge group is continuously broken to the to the torus. And then somehow in part of the space, I look at it as the effective theory on the fifth abelian theory for the torus. And on the other half, I look at it as original theory. And it should be true that you find the Borel in between, but it's kind of messy to verify. But moving on the space of Vaca is clearly something that you can do on both sides of the duality equally well and should give you the same answer.
Great.
And so if I take endomorphisms of these spaces, of these boundary conditions, as Ben suggested for the previous example, then I'm going to find that G mod U is a 3D mirror to G check mod U check mod U check. Yeah. And that's like sort of a lift of Bezrukhovnikov's.
Or if you like, it's just the Balanchine-Ginzburg circle, the kind of causal duality for G mod B and G check mod U check.
I see, but here you're using G mod U mod U, but that's still okay.
Well, it depends how you think about it, right? I'm thinking about G mod U mod U with a T action. So if you like, I fix the T action, then G mod B mod B. Think of kind of, it's a family's version of that.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Maybe if you want the 3D theory, you can engage the T.
Uh-huh.
But on the other side, it will cost you something. We have to gauge it in three dimensions.
I see. Okay.
It's not symmetric.
May I ask a question? When you talk about quotient by n check, you mean the Hamiltonian reduction, but reduced to the zero value, because otherwise there won't be the T check action.
That's right. No, this is not the Whitaker version. This, if you like, there's a psi parameter. If you like, I've taken the psi to zero. It's not. You can put that into a family, but.
So it's not a single D5 brain, it's something else.
Right. Yeah, it's not exactly. It's not the NAMPO.
It's not the brain.
Yeah.
It's not the brain at all.
Yeah.
It's just a displacement of the D3 brains.
Okay. Great. Wait, am I supposed to break at some? I don't really remember what my. I mean, I'm about to. I don't know, a fifth of the way in, but
you should take a break relatively soon, whenever you find convenient.
Okay. Okay. So maybe I'll do something wicked and rush the next subject. let me try this, and this is too wicked. Then we'll. We'll revisit it after. So I don't want to spend the rest of the talk on the number theory, but let me just try to give the dictionary that I'm going to be using how to match this story with number theory. And then we'll try to get more into the kind of content of what, so the kind of dictionary for, if you like, the kind of between the arithmetic Langlands and topological field theory. And this is, there's this thing that I think, I don't know, people call the MMM, I forgot their initials, the MMMR. I mean, there's Mazur, Mumford, Morishita, and then there's Kapranov and Resnikov and Minyoung Kim should be mentioned. There's a dictionary associated with all those names, which people often call the knots and primes dictionary. But the basic idea is that if I give you, the way I'm going to think about it, I give you a global field. And by global field, we can mean here either a number field, so if they think of QQ, or could think of the function field of a curve over a finite field. And this is really maybe the more geometric setting where I'd like to think. And then if given a global field where you should think of maybe spec of its ring of integers, so I'm just going to say think of F itself, or in the arithmetic, it's to think of the curve over finite field itself as a three manifold. That's sort of the basic kind of like dogmatic statement. You should, and there's a lot of justification why it behaves as a three manifold from the point of view of the Talc homology, but I'm not going to get into that. We're just going to imagine that whenever you see this kind of arithmetic situation, you have a number field or you have a curve over a finite field, you should think of this as a three manifold. it's going to be an unoriented three-manifold. In the number field situation, it'll be a non-compact three-manifold where we have to deal with the Archimedean places. And so that's what we have to always treat those separately. But in any case, you should think about it as a three-manifold. For example, in the case of a curve over a finite field, the picture I have in mind is if I have a curve over a finite field, I want to think about it as a three-manifold fibered over the circle, where you think of a curve over an algebraically closed field. A curve over algebraically closed field, you should really think of as a surface. That's the dictionary we've been taught for a long time. But if you have a curve over a finite field, you shouldn't think of it as a surface. You should think of it as a three-manifold. Namely, we have this Frobenius. If it's the curve is defined over a finite field, it has this diffeomorphism given by Frobenius. And we're going to think about the mapping torus of this surface. So given a surface with a diffeomorphism, you can construct a three-manifold fibered over the circle. And that's how I want to think about the, so the total space. So the fiber is a curve over a finite field. The total space is, I want to think about a curve. So it's a curve over FQ bar. The total space is a curve over a finite field. That's a three-manifold fibered over the circle. And so here the circle is coming from Frobenius. So this is the kind of dictionary. I don't want to justify it, but I want, the reason I want to say it is because by allowing these, I want to think of us as taking the this two field theories, the A theory and B theory we've been discussing, and we're going to try to evaluate it on more three manifolds. We're going to have more manifolds to evaluate them on. We're going to have all these manifolds of arithmetic nature. Well, in fact, you might complain that I never talked about three manifolds before. I only had two manifolds. My surfaces, and there's two manifolds in this picture as well. So for example, if you take a local field, so a local field like QP or FQ Laurent series of T, these should be thought of as two manifolds. And so for example, I can think of the two manifold, you know, have, if I have some three manifold and I have a knot in my three manifold, I can think of the boundary of the tubular neighborhood of that knot, that's a two manifold. So the like with the link of a link is a two manifold. And that's how I want to think about these local fields. So the, this is, if you'd like, this global space is some version of spec Z. Inside of here, I have a knot, which I think of as coming from the prime. So if you like, I have a map, an inclusion of spec of some finite field into spec Z. This is playing the role of some version of the circle. And then the link of this, the link of this knot corresponds to spec of QP, I want to think of as a two manifold. Okay, so yeah, so again, I'm not justifying this, but I'm just trying to propose that we have a lot more three manifolds and two manifolds on which to evaluate our theory. Davide, yes. Sorry, I can't hear you.
Do you think, is there any sense in which some conformal field theories can be evaluated on this kind of two manifolds?
Yes, I mean, I think, I don't know. I mean, I think the answer is yes. I mean, I could tell you the values of you know, these A theory and B theories on, that I, we expect on some of these two manifolds. I don't know directly how to take 2D conformal field theory, what extra structure it is needed to define it arithmetically.
For example, is there something analogous to, I don't know, one over the determinant of the Lebesgue operator on a surface?
Yeah. So I mean, I think that, like, so there are people like Clark Barwick have been thinking about making sense of that directly. I will refer to them. I don't have any. Well, certainly, I mean, you know, maybe I should mention Min-Young Kim is the one who really pushed this idea, the idea that we should think about L functions of Galois representations as some version of Chern-Simons invariants, that you can do a Chern-Simons theory, this is what's called arithmetic Chern-Simons theory, that when you think of Chern-Simons, you know, if you think of the conformal block of Chern-Simons as a section of some determinant bundle in the space of local systems, that's the kind of data that you're evaluating when you're evaluating L functions of Galois representations. And try to make this analogy precise. And there are people who've been working directly to make this precise. That's not the kind of tack I'm going to take. I'm going to think of this as kind of, maybe it's like more metaphorical, but there's a lot of structures that we know in the language program that match perfectly if you think about these arithmetic situations as giving one manifolds, two manifolds, three manifolds with the relations between them.
And the reason I was asking is because sometimes some CFT calculations on standard Riemann surfaces give you, I don't know, some polynomial or something which can be defined over other fields and which can have, you know, nice behavior on the lateral Finchian Hamiltonians, like a transformation. So,
I mean, I think there's certainly, I mean, you know, if you look just at, you know, in the, what, 88 or, you know, Witten's quantum field theory algebraic curves papers, and, you know, the relation between class field theory and conformal field theory, just the kind of free boson theory was, you know, there's a clear sense in which you know what the evaluation of the free boson is and the curves and, you know, their characteristics. So there are definite places where you know what the field theory does on arithmetic manifolds, but okay, I don't know.
Thank you.
Yeah. Justin.
Over the complex numbers, did you guys compute any of these traces, like for interesting elements of the mapping class group? Like, you know, take a boundary condition, get some object.
No, I mean, no. There's a means the answer there. No, yeah. I mean, that would be interesting to, but no, we haven't thought about the mapping class group situation. I mean, I should say, you know, very, very, very little has been done about, if you like, geometric Langlands on three manifolds in general. Mm-hmm. So that's a kind of a funny thing, right? In the arithmetic situation, you know, the Langlands program starts with, if you like, with three manifolds. In geometric Langlands, you know, very, very little has been done on three manifolds.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so maybe so this is just going to be some kind of dictionary that maybe this is a good place to break, because what I'd like to do now is to try to match the kind of structures we're seeing in like these variable Lagrangians, these structures coming from boundary conditions, and try to match them with this theory of periods and L functions under this correspondence. But maybe this is a good place to break.